Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 354, Modular Homes, how Chris Crager launched his Austin, Texas-based developer, design, build, architecture firm, KRDB. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM, specifications, and so much more, and Monograph, the time tracking and project management tool built for architects by architects. Chris Crager, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you for being here. Based in Austin, Texas, Chris Crager formed Crager & Associates Design Build, a developer design build company, in 2001, with the intention of creating financially accessible architecture while focusing on sustainability in the urban environment. KRDB's work has been recognized locally and nationally, including winning the AIA Austin's prestigious Firm Achievement Award in its first year back in 2001. Their work has been published in numerous books, journals, national newspapers. It's been featured on television on shows such as This New House, Small Space, Big Style, Dream Builders, Dwell TV, and What You Get for Your Money. KRDB's Saul Austin project, a 40-unit model for holistic sustainable design, was one of the first net zero capable projects in the United States and has been awarded with several honors and was featured on the front page of the New York Times home section. In 2008, KRDB introduced Modular, their line of affordable modular modern homes, and are currently working on projects in Austin, Los Angeles, Dallas, and New York. What began as a single family endeavor has now grown into include projects ranging in a scale from 4-unit small lot development to a 135-unit, 150,000 square foot project on 6 acres. So Chris, you and your team have most certainly been busy doing what you do. And so I want to learn how this all began. So I would love to sort of start off with your origin story. So go back to where you discovered your passion for architecture and tell us that journey from that point to where you find yourself today.
Right. So I began in undergraduate school. I was pre-law initially. I had a lawyer convince me not to become a lawyer. I switched degrees to general business administration with an emphasis in finance. Thought I was going to get into the financial markets. I had a stockbroker about a month before graduating convinced me not to do that. I worked in, I then graduated from undergraduate school in a recession in 1990 and took a job in banking because I didn't know what I was going to do. With the idea that I had an inkling that I needed a creative outlet. But so I worked in banking in Chicago for 5 years. I was running a mortgage brokerage that did about $60 million a year in mortgage loans. And then I just happened upon, I kind of decided that I needed a creative outlet, but I also wanted to be able to leverage what I felt were my analytical strengths. And so I had a friend who was in graduate school in architecture in Chicago at the time at UIC, and I saw what she was doing, and I thought, you know, this seems like this seems ideal. I also had a couple of clients as a banker who were doing like turn, you know, flips where they were buying real estate and fixing them up, but they weren't doing it in a very interesting way. And so, coming into, I happened upon the program at UT Austin, total coincidence, through a mutual friend, came down to Austin to visit. Really liked the program, liked the, they had a, I thought they had a really great kind of balance of theory and practice at the time. Had people who were interested in building buildings, but they also had people who were pushing the envelope tech, you know, with technology like Marcus Novak. And so I decided to come to Austin.
And pretty entrepreneurial program as well, right?
Yeah.
At UT?
Mm-hmm, yes, exactly. Yeah. So the faculty, you know, the diversity of the program, and then Austin City, which actually to me 26 years ago was a big town, wasn't quite a city yet. So I came to UT Austin to go to grad school and thought I would leave and go to New York or LA or maybe back to Chicago. But what I realized is that I took a slightly unconventional route to practice in that I wasn't interested in doing the typical thing of going and working for a marquee architect, working my way up the food chain. And I wanted to, having run a small business already, also in undergraduate school, I worked as a framer in the summertime to put myself through school. I'd worked in banking. I had my real estate license. I had worked in construction. Right out of graduate school, one of my former partner, Christopher Robertson, he and I started chatting and we had a common interest in accessible architecture and figuring out a way to design buildings that people could afford. I was immediately enamored of architecture, but I didn't know anyone growing up that lived in an architect-designed home. So this idea that we could provide high quality design at an affordable price point was what motivated the practice. And we also thought, oh, we're a couple of guys just out of graduate school. You know, no one's going to hire us to do this. So we were very fortunate to be in Austin and have the city of Austin has had one of the first green builder programs in the country, but they also had a thing called the Smart Housing Program, which was targeted to give incentives to builders and homeowners. There was a first-time home buyer component, and there was also a small builder loan program. So we went out and we bought a couple of lots in East Austin for $15,000. I think I put them on a credit card. We were able to secure a construction loan through the city's small builder program. And we built these two small houses that were, you know, green builder rated, went to first time home buyers. So this was the start of the practice. It was vertically integrated from the beginning. We developed, designed, built, sold. It was interesting. We had a woman from the local newspaper, the Statesman, call and say she wanted to write an article. We were going to have an open house and she wanted to write an article for us. It was actually going to be in the business section. It wasn't in the design or, you know, home section. And so she interviewed us about what we did. We mentioned that there was going to be an open house. And that Sunday, we had this open house. And, you know, I brought the Sunday paper because I figured that, you know, a few people would come. Well, we ended up having 750 people come, news crews. Like it was a crazy response, you know, which really for us just kind of affirmed this assumption that we had that people were interested in affordable, accessible design.
Is that how you launched the firm, with those two houses?
With those two houses.
That was the first thing you did?
Well, and then what happened was one of the editors, early editors of Dwell, who was from Texas originally, Allison was from Texas, and someone sent her this article in the Statesman, and Dwell called us and said, and this was early days of Dwell, I think they were around for a year, and they said, we wanted to look at your project. And so they came and they shot it, and then they said, oh, it's going to be on the cover. So our first project ended up being on the cover of Dwell magazine. We won an AIA award for the project, and we also were awarded the Firm Achievement Award our first year in existence, which some people took umbrage with.
Yeah, let me jump in, because I don't want to get past this too fast, because it sounds like, if from the outside, it sounds like, okay, two guys came together, let's build a couple of houses, and then all of a sudden all this luck poured down on top of you, right? That's what it looks like. But right. You also gave me your origin story. You started in law school. You worked your way through business school. You focused on finance. You went out and worked in finance. You got your real estate license. You had this finance background, worked in mortgages, understood that part of it, and then went to architecture school. So you took all of that knowledge, right, brought it to architecture school, came out of architecture school with a completely different background, completely different perspective on the profession than anybody else that comes out of architecture school.
Right.
And so it's not surprising to hear that your first project was an investment development that then became successful, right? Because of all this background that you had, all this knowledge was all leading up to this moment. And you may have not even recognized it at that moment, but looking back at it, it sort of makes all sense on how that all happened, right?
Right. And to me, I honestly, the way I look at it is, I can't imagine it happening another way. I mean, for me, it just felt a kind of a natural course of events. And I think one of the things that attracted me to architecture was the ability to kind of build a practice and a career of your own kind of interests, and the same thing, the same skills and qualities that make a good architect are also the things that attract me to building a small business and being a developer, and like being able to identify the opportunities and put the pieces together, take all these kind of individual elements and see a kind of a pattern or whatnot, and to pull them together in a project. And so that's kind of a strand that runs through our practice, whether it's on the development side, it's on the construction technology side. I think probably if it had been more popular when I was young, I would have been diagnosed with ADD. I think my practice suits me in that way, in that there's a lot of juggling going on, and mm-hmm. I think I perform most efficiently when I have all of these elements that I'm having to kind of balance at one time. So it felt a little inevitable to me. And it was interesting too, because we had people with the success of the first project. I remember getting interviewed and people ask me, well, are you worried about competition, that people are going to see what you do and imitate what you do? And it was just such a strange question to me. And I said, well, no, quite on the contrary. Like, the reason what will be success to me is that people do that, is
right,
that people see that and say, oh, well, look, there's, you know, here's this opportunity. And so, and I think in retrospect, almost 20 years later, you know, now, you know, what we do now is not like a really novel. There's a lot of people who do design build, and the type of work that we do, and something that's a little more affordable and accessible. You see it, especially with the growth, kind of return to the central city. There's a lot more of this type of work happening. But when we were first doing this 20 years ago, especially in a town like Austin, it was something that was new. So.
Yeah. The pure definition of an entrepreneur architect, mm-hmm. you know, that you've taken all these skills and have started from scratch as an architect, builder, developer, right? All these things that so many architects wish they could be, right? They want to do that. They all are excited about, you know, wanting to design and build their own homes and develop developments. And, but very few take the steps to do it. We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, and Monograph. RCAT.com has been assisting architecture professionals in their search for the best products for their projects for nearly 30 years. Starting as a printed desktop reference with listings in manufacturers' catalogs, RCAT has evolved into the number one most used website for finding building product information. Today, RCAT is an invaluable tool for AEC professionals, offering a powerful product search engine that's backed up by up-to-date CAD, BIM, and specifications. And just as it was in 1991, today, RCAT offers all of this at no cost to their users and without requiring any registration. It's free. Visit entrearchitect.com/RCAT today and see why architecture professionals have leveraged the power of RCAT for three decades. entrearchitect.com/RCAT. That's entrearchitect.com/ARCAT. Spreadsheets. Spreadsheets. Are you tired of using spreadsheets to keep track of your project plans, your budgets, your staff, your time? Our friends at Monograph know what that's like because they're architects too. They know all about that spreadsheet mess that you're dealing with. So they did something about it. Monograph is a time tracking and project management tool built for architects by architects to respond to the challenges that small and medium-sized firms face on their quest to a profitable business. With Monograph's integrated suite of tools, you'll stay on track and on budget without the overhead of wrangling spreadsheets every day. Improve your firm's operations today. Try Monograph. Try it for free at entrearchitect.com/monograph. Ditch the spreadsheets. Visit entrearchitect.com/monograph and try Monograph right now for free. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
If you had some advice for people who would like to do that, right? Either somebody starting an architecture firm and wants to follow a similar model that you did, or somebody that's more established that's always wanted to do something similar to you, where it's design, build, development, affordable, sustainable buildings, what would you suggest they start with? Where do they sort of get the first step?
Well, I think the first thing they have to do is measure, take a kind of a reading of what their risk aversion is, because it's just not for everyone.
Yeah.
Building buildings is complicated and difficult and messy and frustrating. And when you start to layer these other things on top of it, taking the financial risk, adding the kind of component of looking for the opportunities on the development side, dealing with the financial institutions, having that savvy. Those are things that add kind of layers of complexity and potential agita to your life. And so I think understanding that you're suited for that kind of thing is probably the most important. And if you are, and if you realize that you are, I think that there's great opportunity there because there aren't a lot of, I don't think there are truly a lot of people who can do that and maintain their sanity. And so, once you recognize that you don't have that risk aversion, I think there's a lot of opportunities out there. And what we've found is that, we've never marketed our firm. And part of that is because people have seen what we've done and they've come to us. And one of the things I would say is look for opportunities to joint venture. We've done almost most of our projects have been joint ventures with partnerships. And those vary in terms of like, sometimes it's, somebody is just bringing, it might be cash or land to the table and then we're doing everything else. I also have much more involved partners. All the projects I'm doing in Los Angeles are with one development outfit there called Leap of Faith Ventures. And they're very actively involved and we co-develop and they're very involved with the design and they have a concrete company. So they're involved in the construction So, you know, looking for opportunities. I mean, what I've done is I've tried to kind of leverage other people's assets that we try to maximize. Because a lot of people say, well, I don't have the money to do this. Well, you don't necessarily have to have truckloads of cash to do this. You can, you need to get creative about that, and you can find these opportunities. And it could be as simple as finding somebody in your neighborhood who has a lot, an empty lot, who's been sitting on it for a long time, and they have equity in it. And I've done this. I've one of my first mixed use projects. I was introduced to the gentleman who owned the small tract of land, and he agreed to put it under land contract with me. So, you know, it's once you recognize your lack of risk aversion, going out there and finding these kind of opportunities, I think is, you know, is a great way. And they can, they're small, you know, do a small spec house, something like that. Look for opportunities to kind of leverage that through ventures.
Yeah. Very good advice.
And then you grow these things. I mean, over time we've gone from doing one house or two houses to four to eight. To our sole development was 40 units on 38 lots on 5 acres. That was we actually partnered with a not-for-profit on that project to provide 40% of his affordable housing. So, you know, we just grew exponentially over time, the scale of the projects we've taken on.
Has everything you've done been affordable and sustainable? Was that the primary focus?
No, I mean, the level of sustainability, I mean, I would say that we're, you know, we don't, on our sole project, all of the houses were rated through the Austin Green Builder Program. They were either 4 or 5 stars. Some of the projects we do by virtue of the partnerships we're in, where that, sustainability to a degree, let's say of having a kind of certification is not a mandate for the partners, it may not necessarily, you know, go through LEED or Green Builder or something like that. Yeah. What we've learned over time is that we have a certain kind of a baseline kind of construction specification that we're going to build to, that we know is going to hit a benchmark. If it goes through a rating or how the building is going to perform. And we've done a lot of post-occupancy monitoring where we can see, you know, hey, if we build with X, Y, and Z, you know, we'll be able to hit a certain kind of level of performance on a building. So even if we're not going for a rating, a sustainability rating on a project, we know we're hitting a baseline level of sustainability with the performance of the building. And then in terms of the affordability, it's a similar thing. When we can, we integrate affordability. I mean, I would say in general, the work that we do, even if they're just say spec houses, compared in the market to what most of my colleagues build for on a per square foot basis, our projects are much more approachable and affordable. So, you know, they're not necessarily hitting 60 or 80% median family income, but we're putting, you know, we've put houses on the ground that are selling in the market that are comparable on a per square foot cost to, a more conventional house. So, but we've hit the kind of affordability benchmark again across the spectrum and based on, from a project to project basis, how deeply targeted that's going to go. You know, we usually have to apply for subsidies if we're going to try to hit a 60% MFI or something like that. And so it varies from project to project.
Do you find that there's a higher demand for your architecturally designed homes compared to a big box developer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that, like I said, when we started building this type of, you know, people weren't building modern spec houses in Austin 18 years ago. Now, I mean, Austin's had a boom. I mean, we're about to be the 10th largest city in the country. I think we're going to pass San Jose shortly. And a lot of that development has been central. And so I've watched over the 18 years that the building stock in the market changed pretty dramatically. Going from kind of very conventional construction, both in type and design, aesthetic, to, you know, I won't say a majority, but when you look at what's, you know, houses that are built on spec in central Austin, you know, quite a few of them have an architect involved, have a kind of modern design elements to them. So I think we've seen that interest and that demand for design manifest in what's provided in the market. And we've watched, you know, I've watched, for example, the AIA Homes tour here in Austin, you know, grow from being relatively small tour to now, I think they have 5,000 people a year, you know, and we've had, you know, several years we've had homes on the tour, and it's remarkable to see the level of interest in design in the general public and how that's grown over 20 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I, you know, if a home buyer who doesn't really have options, right, their options are the big builders, mm-hmm. Suddenly are presented with an option for a house that's similar in cost, probably more sustainable, and is a architecturally designed home, that many of them probably would prefer the architecturally designed home.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think an anecdote that's relevant to that is that we were getting a zoning change for our sole development. We were going from a SF3, which is a standard single family, to SF4A, which is small lot. We needed to, we didn't have to, but there's a neighborhood organization in where the property was. And so having the support of the neighborhood group when you go to the planning commission, zoning and planning, is tremendously helpful. And so we went, and where we were building this project is historically a Latino neighborhood. And there's a group called PODER, which is an environmental activist group, and they're very active in the neighborhood. And we went into the meeting to pitch the project. Of course, we had with us our not-for-profit partner, who we were providing 40% of the housing at affordable levels, both rental and purchase, and that ranged from 30 to 80% median family income. And so we pitched the project, and they loved the idea of the affordability and the sustainability. And then they started asking us about the aesthetics of the project, and I anticipated there being a little pushback on this. So I said, listen, we showed you the work. What I'd really like to do is, if anyone's interested, I'll take you on a tour of some houses. And so we had, I think, a dozen folks from this meeting asked to come along, and we took them, I think, to three different projects. And at the end of this, I had, I think, three or four of them asking us when our project was going to be done. They were very interested.
They want first on the list.
I think when people, and I've even seen this within my own family. I mean, my sisters and my parents, you know, they didn't have familiarity with architect modern design. And when I started doing this and they started seeing and walking through and experiencing the spaces, what I found, gosh, almost without exception, is that people just respond really positively to it.
Yeah.
And often what it is, they just don't even recognize what they've been missing in these, you know, buildings that they've been dwelling in, which is, again, just speaks to the whole purpose and raison d'etre of the practice, to kind of bring this to a larger cross-section of the population. So, yeah, I mean, I think people definitely respond to it when they have the opportunity to experience it. And it's been really rewarding to see that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're probably inspiring some of the big developers because I'm in North Carolina in Charlotte, and you know, lots and lots of development happening, and you see a few architecturally designed homes happening. And then you start seeing some of the big builders start mm-hmm. using modern elements. They don't design it like an architect would design it, but they like pick and choose, and they're like, oh, but they put this little modern detail on this, you know, house and make it a modern traditional house. Right. But they're doing, if you see them doing that, it's because there's a demand for modern architecture.
Well, yeah. And what they've seen is they've seen that, like, almost without fail, we've done spec projects. Our houses will sell at the top of the comp mark in that area. So we'll have the higher per square foot values. And then on resales, I can't tell you how many projects I've seen resell two times, three times, and thought, oh, I wish I would have held on to that. And on some level, we're I have mixed feelings about that because we're on some level we're it's a bit of a victim of our own success that people be like, oh well, your houses are more expensive than other houses in the neighborhood. But I say it's because it's a qualitative thing,
right?
You know, and then hopefully once you know there's more of this in a market, that will naturally, you know, we won't just float to the top, if that, you know, we'll be in the middle because, or wherever, because hopefully eventually there's a larger volume of higher quality design out there in the market. I might be a little Pollyanna-ish, but.
Yeah, but that's what we all hope, right? I mean, if we can have an influence in the way that development is being done, and it's a positive influence, then even if it's minor, it's better than us not being involved.
Right.
So the people who are directly involved certainly benefit from being part of what we do. But if what we're doing is successful, the developers will see that success and they will start being influenced by that as well.
Absolutely. And we've had, you know, we've been approached many times, even right out of the gate by developers who've seen what we've done and seen it published and we're interested in that. And you know, most of those haven't manifest, but we've done quite a few projects over the years. Our level of service varying again from project to project, but with folks who have seen what we're doing and are interested in integrating that in other markets. So,
yeah, very interesting. Before we wrap up, I wanted to talk a little bit about your firm structure. How many people in the firm? How is it structured? Like, what is your role in this in the firm? Just so people can sort of have an idea of who's doing the work that you're providing.
So we're a 10-person firm, you know, the structure in the firm is I guess somewhat typical. You know, we have project managers under me. They have project assistants, you know, drafting people. But then we also have, because we're a design build firm, I have superintendents who are out in the field full time overseeing. You know, we typically will have, oh, I don't know, six, half dozen or so projects going in a variety of scales at any given time. The thing though, and when we interview folks, the thing that we, you know, even though we're a small firm, the thing that we kind of warn people about is that because we're a vertically integrated firm, when they come in, it's going to be a very different experience than, say, going to work for a big firm where you typically will, you know, you'll be put on a team, you know, especially early on, your path is pretty prescribed. People in our office end up getting involved in all aspects of the project, you know, getting a glimpse of what the development side looks like, working on, you know, proposals, whether they be design kind of schematic proposals, financial modeling, and then obviously through a design process, and then we're doing all of the, you know, we're a general contractor, and so we're overseeing the construction. And so on a daily basis, they could be working on one of any of those elements of a project. So, you know, I mean, to me, I like that. I like that on a day-to-day basis that I, you know, I'm doing, but that's not everyone's cup of tea. So it's something that we forewarn people, and hopefully that's something that excites them when they come in, you know, that kind of variety of experience. So,
yeah. And it's certainly, I think people who have experience in construction become better architects because they understand how the buildings go together and also how the trades work and think about architects and how you can relate with architects and builders, and the relationships among them improve. And so the building is actually improved by the teamwork that's resulting from that.
Absolutely. And I firmly believe that, I mean, as broad as the architectural education is, it could be well served to integrate. I mean, I honestly think that some experience in construction should almost be mandatory within the architectural curriculum. I was very inspired by the Rural Studio, which was kind of just getting started when I was in grad school. And I asked, oh, do we have a design build program here? And the answer I got back then, which has changed in the interim, was, oh, you'll learn that stuff when you get out there. And as a principal of a practice who's hired dozens of people over the years, I've seen the result of that lack of exposure. And it really, whether that be the construction side, whether that be understanding what goes into entitlements, whether that be the kind of economic, the financial side of it. Those are things that, you know, I would encourage young architects or architects who are still in grad school or undergraduate school to try to get. You know, there's not a whole lot of latitude in your it's a very concentrated curriculum, but if you can take some of those courses in, you know, real estate or finance, et cetera, I think that getting that exposure, or like I did, worked in construction in the summers, those things are highly beneficial to an architect's practice.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Do you design everything that's being comes out of your firm, or you have designers working with you?
Yeah, I mean, I am on the team. I am involved in every project, and I'm project manager. So I'm very involved early on in the kind of pre-design and schematic design phase, and then I get very involved in the kind of when things go into construction, the middle portion. I kind of leave to my project managers and project architects. But yeah, I mean, it's been something, you know, struggling with like how to grow, because we've certainly had opportunities to get bigger. And it's something that at some point where you can't wrap your arms around it anymore. I almost feel like, well, what's the point? I mean, I don't have a business partner, so I want to make sure that I'm always able to kind of understand and see what's going on with the projects and stay involved with them. So.
Yeah. And then just another technical question. Are the companies, are the build side and the design side two separate companies?
They're not. It's
all one company.
Yeah. You know, and that's on some level, it's just a practical issue. And I think this was something that I probably vetted with my CPA and my attorney years ago. And then on the insurance side, you know, it's hard to get insurance as a design build firm. I mean,
that's the biggest question.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Your E&O, there's a handful of firms, that will give you E&O. That's the harder part. I mean, I can get the general liability is not a problem, but the E&O stuff is trickier. I don't remember the exact kind of conversation, but I remember vetting this with my attorney and my CPA, and it just made, you know, sense for to be one LLC. Now we do create separate contracts. I have a design contract, mm-hmm. and we have a contract for on the construction side.
So you're being hired twice. So yeah, you're being hired to design it, and then you're being hired to build it.
Right, and you know, usually going into the design contract, the client's assumption and our assumption is that we will be building it. But the conversation we have is that for whatever reason, there may be, you may decide, you know, your brother-in-law may want to build it or whatnot. It says, I have been doing this from day one. We just separate those two. So.
Yeah. Yeah. What's one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I would say, don't be afraid to go out there and kind of make your own opportunities. Like I was mentioning earlier, like look for the opportunities to create joint ventures. It's a way to leverage your way into a project of a type and scale that you might not be able to handle on your own, but it affords you opportunities that may either take longer or you may never have. And there are so many people out there who need the skill set of a good architect and a good designer to make a project that is, you know, whatever, however, you know, better to what degree, I don't know, but that will recognize those the benefit of having that on board. Don't be afraid to go after those and create those opportunities for yourself.
Very inspiring. Chris Kreger is his name, krdb.com. If you'd like to go check out his website, see all the work that he's doing, the modular work that he's doing. We didn't really talk much about modular, but you're doing a lot of work in modular with a new modular company called Ma Modular. You can look and find more information on that at mamodular.com. We'll have links to both websites on the show notes. Maybe you can come back and we can talk more about modular. Chris, thank you. This has been very inspiring. I think there are many, many architects who look at your work and say, well, I wish I could do that. And you just gave them permission to go do it. And so I appreciate you for doing that, for joining us here, and for sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are listening to episode 354. If you'd like to access the show notes or share this episode with a friend, the link is entrearchitect.com/episode354. 354 is the episode number. entrearchitect.com/episode354 is the link to share. Please do that. That helps us grow the podcast every week because you are sharing that link. entrearchitect.com/episode354. Entree Architect is proud to be a part of the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. If you haven't been there, gablemedia.com. It's gablemedia.com. We are curating thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. We're working to bring the best of AEC content to one place so you can find it really very easily. Podcast and video channels. You can listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And this week at Entree Architect, at the community, throughout the community on the platform, Entree Architect, we introduced a new free 3-module training program for the Entree Architect community. And you're invited to access Build Your Brand Basics right now at entrearchitect.com/brandbasics. Our friend, Entree Architect, Director of Brand Strategy, host of Context and Clarity Live inside the Facebook group, and he's the host of the Build Your Brand podcast, Jeff Eccles, and I have been working hard this past month to develop a new on-demand course, a comprehensive course to help architects find the work that they want and earn the fees that they deserve. The Build Your Brand course. It's a comprehensive course that helps you put together a branding system for your architecture firm, and it's available right now. So to introduce that new comprehensive on-demand training program, we developed a separate free version. It's a free version that's available right now at entrearchitect.com/brandbasics. It's a 3-module video training series where Jeff shares the basics of brand building for your architecture firm. Follow the steps that Jeff presents in these videos, and you will be on your way to attracting the clients you want most. That's the way it works. Build a brand, and you will attract the clients that you really want to be working with. There's no catch for this training course. It's completely free. There's no cost. You don't even need to register with your email address. It's there waiting for you right now, and you are invited to access Build Your Brand Basics at entrearchitect.com/brandbasics. Jeff and I hope you find it super useful. So go grab it. entrearchitect.com/brandbasics. My friends, be well, be happy, healthy, safe, and secure. Have a fantastic holiday. We'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
you know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gehry. Visit glenngehry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.